music, fun, and banter with R&R, weekdays 1 till 3.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. On this show, we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. Andrew Ferguson is off this week. Primary election runoffs will be held on May 28th, so if you need to register to vote or to update your voter registration information, now is a good time to take care of that. Consider it a form of Texas two-step. Links to county election sites for Harris and adjacent counties can be found at the bottom of this week's blog post. Our first story is from CommunityImpact.com. League city officials to vote on flag design at city council meeting. League City officials could choose its new flag design as well as approve a couple of master plans tied to water and wastewater at its March 26th City Council meeting. What do you need to know? Well, League City officials could take action on approving the city's new official flag on March 26th, according to agenda documents. There are three different styles, with each style having four options. When considering the design, officials followed basic principles from the North Atlantic Vexillological Association, which is an international organization dedicated to the study of flags, according to the organization's website. Now, I thought this was an interesting story because cities don't choose new flags every day, but I found the story deficient in three ways. First, the author says that the city council could choose a flag. The proposed resolution seems to say they will. Maybe they won't. Honestly, I'm unsure. Second, the exhibit file shows four designs, each in one of three color palettes. This doesn't seem like it's down to a final choice. Third, the author provided no link for viewing the prospective flags in question, although I have added them at the bottom of my post for this story. I had to expend quite a bit of effort digging that up on my own, and given the subject of the story, I consider this a significant omission. In a final observation, I wasn't able to pose any of this to the author for clarification. Community Impact writers used to have email links. This seems to no longer be the case, and I am not happy about it. In any case, the League City City Council will meet at 6 p.m. Wednesday, March 26th at the City Council's Chambers, 200 West Walker Street, League City. Finally, FYI, I think my preference of the choices available is flag number 3A. Our next story is also from CommunityImpact.com. Houston child care facilities eligible to receive new property tax exemption. Members of the Houston City Council passed an amendment on March 20th to provide a tax exemption for child care facilities as soon as the 2024-25 tax year. According to a March 20th news release, the new amendment made to Section 44-30 of the city's Code of Ordinances will allow qualifying child care facilities to claim a partial or complete exemption from their property taxes. To qualify for the exemption, child care providers must meet certain requirements. They must be a licensed child care facility, be a Texas Rising Star program participant, and at least 20% of a school's enrolled children must be in the Texas Workforce Commission's Child Care Services program. According to the Texas Workforce Commission, cities and counties can exempt anywhere from 50 to 100% of the appraised value of the property. Houston City Council approved a 100% exemption. Mayor John Whitmire said the new amendment will significantly impact child care providers and the families they serve. Applications for the tax exemption are being developed developed. According to the release, the county has advised qualifying child care providers to stand by for the official release, expected sometime during the last week of March. Before I say what I'm going to say, just know that I understand what a financial burden child care is for working parents. While I'm far from being an expert in this area, I think it's really unusual for a profit-making business of any sort to get a 100% property tax exemption. If there's a catch, maybe it's that at least 20% of a school's enrolled children must be in the Texas Workforce Commission's Child Care Services Program. I see this as a way to induce more child care facilities to be in-network, as it were. Now, why would I consider that a catch? Well, to the extent that this exemption makes sense to the public that will have to make up the tax shortfall created by the exemption, the public benefit might be that child care costs should be reduced and made more affordable, at least to some who are most in need as a result. The city really has no way to mandate that, so my suspicion is that Texas Workforce Commission's child care pays a below-market rate or gets some kind of standard discount. The Texas Workforce Commission is funded by unemployment taxes, and those taxes are paid entirely by employers. For a pro-business place like Texas, this incentive could make sense, but with two caveats. First, the TWC child care discount should not be balanced by cost increases to parents not in the program. And second, this program should not be used to pad profit margins at the expense of all the other property taxpayers in Houston. So, we'll have to see how this works out. Our next story is a brief little note from the Texas Tribune. The Associated Press and Texas Tribune to share select news content in new collaboration. The AP and Texas Tribune today announced a content-sharing agreement in which both organizations will benefit from each other's journalism. The Texas Tribune will receive access to AP's Texas News and its comprehensive immigration coverage from across the United States and beyond. The AP will now distribute the Tribune's reporting on Texas to its members and customers, complementing the news organization's existing coverage of the state. And there's a little bit more. But this is the crux of it. And this is an unusual story for me to mention since it's about news-gathering organizations. Gathering news. But I feel it matters for a couple of reasons. First, neither the Texas Tribune nor the Associated Press have paywalls. In an era when lies are free but actual facts are often paywalled, this is a big deal. Second, this alliance will expand the breadth and resources of both organizations, and anything that expands news gathering potential in an era of contracting news outlets should be celebrated. Our next story is also from the Texas Tribune. Governor Greg Abbott says Texas is two House votes away from passing school vouchers. Governor Greg Abbott on Wednesday urged school voucher supporters to make the final push in the May primary runoff elections to bring a pro-school voucher majority to the Texas House. Delivering the opening speech at an annual conservative policy conference in Austin, Abbott declared that the school voucher movement was, quote, on the threshold of success after the March 5th primary. The election saw several anti-voucher Republican incumbents lose to pro-voucher challengers, putting pro-voucher members on the verge of a majority in the Texas House, the last legislative roadblock to the policy. Abbott said, "We are now at 74 votes in favor of school choice in the state of Texas, which is good, but 74 does not equal 76, he said, referring to the number of votes he needs to pass the bill into law. We need two more votes. The May 28th Republican primary runoffs carry more opportunities for what I call the self-styled school choice, those are my words, movement to pick up more voucher-supporting members, and Abbott said, we should be able to win that. However, those votes aren't guaranteed, and that tally assumes no surprises in the general election in November. House leadership, including Speaker Dade Phelan and the Republican caucus campaigning apparatus, are financially backing State Representative Justin Holland of Rockwall and his fellow anti-voucher incumbents in the runoffs. However, not everyone in leadership is supporting the anti-voucher members. At a Texas Policy Summit panel that immediately followed Abbott's speech, State Senator Briscoe Kane of Deer Park said he's tired of playing nice on negotiating for anything other than full universal vouchers. Quote, I hope every one of the people that win the runoff are pro-school choice, and if you're supported by a teacher union, I don't want you back, Kane said. It's that easy. Every dollar, just so you know, every dollar given to vouchers is a dollar from public education. Public education needs more, not fewer public dollars. In addition, those vouchers will often go to either elite private schools that children are already attending or to religious schools that unavoidably include some religious indoctrination, thus violating the First Amendment's separation of religion and state. Elections have consequences. Be sure to be registered to vote. and vote. Consider it a form of Texas Two-Step. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. We're also on Google Podcasts, which can be downloaded from both the Android or iPhone app stores. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the landing page. Shows and articles go back to May of 2010, so you can also type keywords into the search bar. Shows now are about 80% scripted, so you can visually scan episodes' text if there is one particular topic in which you might be interested. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Our next story is also from Texas Tribune. Cities across the U.S. are abandoning bus stations. This East Texas town is embracing its bustling depot. And the story goes like this. Michelle Smith never learned to drive. The 54-year-old East Texas woman has relied upon public transport for most of her life. She fondly remembers long trips across the state with her grandmother on Greyhound buses. After she married, her husband drove her until he died 6 years ago. That's when she returned to the bus station. Which is why, on a recent Wednesday afternoon, she was sitting in a Longview bus station, a trash bag of clothes in the seat beside her, a purse and a water bottle from the hospital in her lap. Smith, who was recovering from surgery, was debating whether to use the local bus system to take care of errands or jump on a Greyhound to Tyler. Either way, she could go anywhere she wanted from Longview's renovated bus depot, a central hub for the town's carless population and other travelers. Scenes like this are becoming rare in the U.S. nationwide. Nationwide bus stations are closing in cities like Richmond, Philadelphia, and Dallas. A major shakeup in the mass transit industry, coupled with a shift in ridership following the COVID-19 pandemic, is driving the closures, experts say. Flixbus, a Germany-based company, bought Greyhound's massive fleet of buses in 2021. At the same time, 20 Lake Holdings, a subsidiary of Alden Global Capital, bought Greyhound's property and other assets. All the while, bus companies are shifting to pick up and drop off passengers at hotels, shopping centers, and on roadsides instead. Longview transportation officials were surprised to learn Greyhound planned to close its station in June of 2022. Scott Lewis, the Longview Transit general manager, said he saw Greyhound as a piece of a much larger transit system. To suddenly lose that part of it just didn't make sense, he said. Longview went to work and reached a deal with Greyhound months later to reboot services. The deal included a small amount of new revenue for the city. The city also opted to renovate the bus station, which concluded with a ceremonial ribbon cutting in May of 2023. Nearly a year into its investment, Longview officials are pleased with their decision, as is Flixbus. Courtney Castaneda, a spokesperson for the company, said, "This is an ideal solution for communities as Greyhound loses access to its bus stations." She said, "Given that intercity bus travel frequently involves transfers to reach destinations, these connections, whether within a single carrier or between interlined carriers, underscore the necessity for robust public-private partnerships." Earlier this month, passengers reclined on benches just outside the terminal doors, enjoying the breeze, even as clouds brought intermittent sprinkles of rain. The flow of people inside the terminal a few blocks outside of downtown Longview ebbed as buses pulled in and out. Among the mass transit companies that operate at the depot, Amtrak, Longview Transit, the local bus service, and GoBus, a regional line. Greyhound also picks up and drops off passengers at this location as part of the deal the city struck with the company 2 years ago. Takita Dudley, the Longview Transit Director of Operations, said the bus station is busy for a city of Longview's size. In a community of 82,531 people, Longview's transit system provided more than 135,000 trips in 2022, the latest agency profile shows. "Our depot is very well alive and used in this city," she said. "We get hundreds of people every day. People come through and they see it's empty and think nothing is happening here, but when the train comes in and the buses come in, this depot's busy." As part of the deal the city struck with Greyhound, Longview Transportation employees on Dudley's team manage a ticket counter. This was important to city officials who saw mass confusion among bus riders after Greyhound closed its terminal at the bus depot. Longview also won a $96,000 grant from the Federal Transit Administration to expand the dispatch and customer service desk, install new lighting and flooring, and to paint the facility. Because the Federal Transit Authority requires matching grant funds, the Texas Department of Transportation stepped in for the initial grant. And as part of the contract with Greyhound, Longview receives a small commission for selling tickets, which the city is using to bolster the grant funds account for future projects. In Houston, Greyhound relocated its main terminal from downtown as it lost access to the land. Residents in Magnolia Park, where the new pickup point is, told the Houston Landing they worried the crime in the city's old Greyhound bus station would take root in the new station, now located closer to their homes. Likewise, city leaders in Dallas are searching for solutions to the pending closure of the downtown Greyhound station, one of which is the establishment of a hub where a proposed high-speed rail line would stop in the city, if built. This proposal was met with both celebration and criticism. Community developers worry about how it would impact real estate development, while city leaders see this as a way to support people who wouldn't be mobile otherwise. Michael Walk, a research scientist at Texas A&M Transportation Institute, said he saw value in cities taking over bus depots like Longview. Transportation, he said, is a fundamental need for every person, and it's an economic engine for communities. Even if I don't use those services, they still have value, he said. Other people that I rely on, other people I know, need those services. They need those bus stations and need to be able to do their interregional trips. And it supports the local economy and the Texas economy. It supports the things that I, Michael Walk, rely on day in and day out. Travel within and between cities on buses dropped significantly during the COVID-19 pandemic. Both long bus rides between states and shorter stints between cities such as Dallas to Houston have regained popularity following the steep decline in 2020. Researchers at the Chaddick Institute for Metropolitan Development at DePaul University in Chicago found travel will return to pre-pandemic levels by 2026, according to the annual Intercity Bus Review. Intracity transit has been slow to return in cities like Houston or Austin, but it has returned in full force in smaller metropolitan areas, Walk said in a podcast interview for the Transportation Institute. This results from the type of riders who rely upon these services in smaller urban areas compared to their counterparts. In big cities, there's a mixture of riders who need the bus and those who take transit by choice. The working professionals who could drive if they wish, or college students. In places like Longview, bus riders often have no other option. Having a station is a necessity, not a luxury, for those who use these services, Walk said. There's more detail in the linked article. On the one hand, I think that Longview deserves a lot of credit for seeing a problem that was addressing a need and coming up with solutions that represented a win for all the constituencies involved. In a sense, though, this public-private transportation partnership isn't an entirely new notion of a city involving itself in vital public transit when private enterprise fails at the task. In the latter half of the 19th century, New York City, which at the time constituted only Manhattan and the Bronx, experimented for decades with various privately owned mass transit schemes, always falling short in one way or another, although there were some limited successes. By 1900, the city of Greater New York, incorporating the five boroughs as we know them today, had been created, and mass transit was a problem that simply had to be solved. The solution was to publicly fund a subway system that would be constructed by Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central Company and granted them a lease to run the system for a period of 35 years for a percentage of the fare revenue. After this lease term, full ownership would revert to the city. To this day, the New York Metropolitan Transit Authority is a subsidized system, which basically pays for itself by saving the city from the costs of not having the system. It's a model that has persisted one way or another for over a century, though the details change based on the era and the community's needs. Kudos to Longview for finding some new wrinkles in the model that suit their particular needs. Maybe future transit models will learn from them for their own particular requirements, and maybe states like Texas will help with these regional plans or at least get out of the way. I've also added a reference link that's kind of a lengthy but interesting history of the New York City Rapid Transit decision of 1900. I have to admit, it kind of glazed my eyes over a little bit, but there's a lot of interesting detail in there. Our next story is also from the Texas Tribune. Ken Paxton agrees to community service paying restitution to avoid trial in securities fraud case. Prosecutors on Tuesday agreed, I'm sure you've heard this, but let me get to the end so I can add my comments in. Prosecutors on Tuesday agreed to drop the securities fraud charges facing Attorney General Ken Paxton if he performs 100 hours of community service and fulfills other conditions of a pretrial agreement, bringing an abrupt end to the nearly 9-year-old felony case that has loomed over the embattled Republican since his early days in office. The deal, which landed 3 weeks before Paxton was set to face trial, also requires him to take 15 hours of legal ethics courses and pay restitution to those he accused of defrauding more than a decade ago when he allegedly solicited investors in a McKinney technology company without disclosing that the firm was paying him to promote its stock. The amount of restitution totals about $271,000, prosecutor Brian Weiss said. Paxton will not have to enter a plea under the terms of the agreement. Weiss said he is not necessarily opposed to dropping the charges before the 18 months are up if Paxton makes the payment sooner. He said Paxton cannot use campaign funds to pay restitution. Weiss said, you're going to be shocked at this, he had been besieged by a torrent of phone calls from people who have expressed their monumental displeasure with the fact that these cases are being resolved with a pre-trial intervention. Touting the restitution Paxton now owes to his alleged victims, Weiss said it was more important to secure justice for them than to pursue prison time for Paxton, which he said should only be a priority if the defendant poses a threat to public safety. Of course, it's my personal opinion, but what is Ken Paxton if not a threat to public safety? But continuing onward, Weiss says, I appreciate your concern of those criticizing the outcome. With all due respect, your truth is not the truth. You know only 0.5% of what fellow prosecutor Mr. Jed Silverman and I know about the facts of these cases, and the fact that all of these people have registered their monumental displeasure with what happened in these cases, I submit, probably should have been directed at the ballot box. I'll get to that at the end. Still, Paxton's legal troubles aren't over. His agency continues to face a lawsuit brought by four former top deputies who argue that Paxton improperly fired them in 2020 for reporting him to the FBI. Those whistleblowers told law enforcement they believed Paxton was using his office to benefit Austin real estate mogul Nate Paul. The charges that formed the basis for Paxton's impeachment last year and that are the subject of an ongoing federal investigation. Paxton has denied all wrongdoing. In my opinion, maybe Prosecutor Weiss should re-examine his snooty legal ideas. Political outrage at what appears to be unjust sentences or acquittals derive from perceptions of unfair justice. If he feels that he knows 99% more about this case than people protesting the plea deal, maybe he should make an effort to explain himself instead of being a snob about it. To me, this is just another case of justice delayed for the rich and powerful people. Is justice being avoided? In my lay opinion, Paxton should at least have been required to plead guilty to some misdemeanor, just, you know, for the record. But he's also right about complainers going to the ballot box. Many do not. I constantly repeat myself, for which I apologize, but elections have consequences. Our next story is from KUT News by way of the Texas Tribune. And speaking of Ken Paxton, court challenge from Texas AG Ken Paxton could end Austin's light rail plans. The Attorney General took issue with the financial strategy Austin used to navigate the limits state lawmakers have placed on how Texas cities can raise money. Austin's effort to build a high-frequency urban rail network is facing a challenge from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, whose legal arguments seek to dismantle the funding mechanism behind the voter-endorsed transit expansion. In the court filing, Paxton slammed the city's payment plan for the 10-mile light rail starter system. The financial strategy was designed to navigate the increasingly tight strictures the state legislature has placed on how Texas cities raise money. If the court sides with Paxton, it could kill the light rail expansion known as Project Connect. In November of 2020, Austin voters approved a 21% increase in the maintenance and operations portion of their property tax rate to fund the project. The tax hike generates about $166 million a year and growing. The city transfers tax money to the Austin Transit Partnership, an entity authorized by voters to build and finance light rail. ATP needs big loans to cover the high upfront construction costs. The tax cash helps ATP secure loans and then pay them off. The estimated price tag of $4.7 billion in 2022 dollars could reach $7.1 billion by the time construction starts in current dollars then, according to a draft financial plan in ATP's application for federal grants. The estimate doesn't include interest payments on debt. Federal grants cover up to about half the cost of the light rail system, ATP executives say, but the agency is planning to borrow some $1.75 billion in bonds to kickstart construction, which wouldn't begin until 2027 at the earliest. The politically conservative Texas Attorney General, who's on track to be tried for felony fraud this spring, or maybe not, resurrected arguments he made in a legal opinion last year. Paxton said the maintenance and operations portion of a property tax bill can't be used to pay down public debt. Paxton's filing comes as ATP is asking the state court to remove any doubt about the local government corporation's ability to issue bonds. ATP and the city filed a so-called bond validation lawsuit to preemptively stop the Attorney General from blocking the sale of bond debt, a power he has over local government corporations like ATP. It's part of an effort to protect this voter-approved generational light rail project for generations to come, Mayor Kirk Watson said last month in his newsletter. The statute includes an expedited timeline for the court to act, so the litigation won't drag on for years and years, imperiling the project. In legal documents, ATP insists it is following state law. The city is allowed to collect revenue from a voter-approved tax increase and transfer the money to ATP. As a local government corporation, ATP has the authority to borrow money to carry out its purpose, the agency says in its filing. If a court agrees with Paxton and finds ATP cannot borrow money, it could kill the light rail project. That's exactly what a group of plaintiffs wants. And there's more to the story in some detail. This is another example of a Republican Party that always touts local control and freedom and liberty. Unless they have the ability to dictate or thwart what local government wants, then the heavy hand of the Republican state weighs in. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of light rail. Light rail segregates rail lines from traffic lanes and is permanently fixed in the roadbed. I feel like electric buses offer more flexibility over the long haul as the need for public commuting evolves over time, yet they too can be segregated from main traffic lanes and can override or coordinate with traffic signals for mass transit efficiency. Nonetheless, if that's what the citizens of Austin want, the state of Texas and the big nose of AG Ken Paxton should keep out of the local process. This is just another example of the kind of big, intrusive government that self-described small government Republicans really want. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. You can also hear the show live online from anywhere in the world at kpft.org or listen anytime at archive.kpft.org for previous episodes of this show and about 100 other KPFT programs. KPFT is Houston's community media, and we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied homegrown programming. You can show your support for ThinkWing Radio and KPFT by going to kpft.org and hitting the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick ThinkWing Radio and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and tell people about KPFT and your favorite shows, because spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. Our next story is also from TexasTribune.org. Texas energy companies are betting hydrogen can become a cleaner fuel for transportation. A concrete platform with fading blue paint marks the birthplace of the modern oil and gas industry in southeast Texas. Weather-beaten signs describe how drillers tapped the Spindletop oil well in 1901, a discovery that launched petroleum giants Texaco, Mobil, and Gulf Oil. Nearby, a red pipeline traces a neat path above flat, gravel-covered earth. French company Air Liquide started building this unassuming facility with a wellhead and other machinery on the iconic site in 2014 to store what it believes will be key to an energy revolution, hydrogen. The ground that once released millions of barrels of oil now holds some 4.5 billion cubic feet of highly pressurized hydrogen. The gas is contained in a skyscraper-shaped cavern that reaches about a mile below ground within a subterranean salt dome. Hydrogen promoters see the gas as a crucial part of addressing climate change. If it's produced in a way that creates few or no greenhouse gas emissions, it could provide an eco-friendly fuel for cars, planes, 18-wheelers, and ships, and could power energy-intensive industries such as steel manufacturing. Hydrogen emits only water when used as fuel in fuel cells, but burning it directly can create nitrogen oxides, which can create haze and acid rain. If companies can produce clean hydrogen at a price that's competitive with gasoline or diesel, supporters say it would revolutionize the fuel industry. That's a big if. Hydrogen is among the most common elements in the universe, but on Earth it's typically found bonded with something else, such as carbon. Today, hydrogen is often obtained by isolating it from methane, a mix of carbon and hydrogen that is the main component of natural gas. This process leaves behind carbon dioxide, which worsens climate change if released into the air. Engineers say it's possible to clean up that process by catching the extra carbon dioxide and reusing it, to get more oil out of a well, for example, or injecting it into the earth to store it. Another less polluting method is to split hydrogen from water, which is made up of hydrogen and oxygen, using electricity generated by wind, solar, or nuclear power. Texas has emerged as a leader in producing hydrogen the cheaper way, using abundant supplies of natural gas without capturing the carbon dioxide, of course. Anyway, more than 100 miles of pipelines move that hydrogen to companies that buy it for processes such as removing sulfur from crude oil. Little hydrogen is made from gas with carbon capture or from water in the state or the rest of the country. But producing enough hydrogen cheaply, building the pipelines to move it and the subterranean caverns to store it and finding the customers to buy it requires companies to take some financial risk. That effort is getting a boost from the federal government, which is offering billions of dollars worth of tax credits to kickstart production of hydrogen from gas with carbon capture or from water. The government also plans to divide as much as $7 billion among seven regional clusters of projects to build hydrogen infrastructure, including up to $1.2 billion for projects in Texas and Louisiana that plan to make hydrogen largely from natural gas. Competing to break into the industry are traditional fossil fuel companies, including Chevron and ExxonMobil. Hydrogen advocates say interest by the oil giants is good because they have the money and expertise to tackle such an ambitious project. But environmental groups doubt that fossil fuel companies can make hydrogen from natural gas as cleanly as they say they can. They worry the federal funding will prop up oil and gas companies when the emphasis should be on making hydrogen from water or creating clean power another way. David Schlissel, the co-author of a report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, said in a webinar that producing hydrogen from natural gas is not clean, not low carbon, and cannot and should not be considered a solution to our efforts to solve the world's worsening climate change crisis. And because I excerpt stuff, there is then a chunk of the story which leans heavily on Texas as a potential producer of so-called low carbon hydrogen. Continuing the story, you can always go to the website and go to the blog post and read that part. Anyhow, hydrogen believers envision the fuel could decarbonize industries that are considered hard to electrify. Hydrogen would power planes and trucks that heavy batteries would slow down. It would supply the high heat needed to make cement that electricity could not provide. The new federal tax incentives get hydrogen close, if not all the way, to being able to compete with fossil fuels on price, said Fisher of RMI. The government plans to pay up to $3 per kilogram of what it defines as clean hydrogen, such as that made from water, or up to $85 per metric ton of stored carbon dioxide that's captured after making hydrogen from natural gas. With the subsidies, producing hydrogen from water would cost generally from $4 to $6 per kilogram, and producing it from natural gas would cost generally $2 to $4. Fisher stressed that it would depend on the specifics of the project. The government's goal is to get the cost to $1 per kilogram for both types. The hydrogen solution does not sound so promising to environmental groups, especially when it comes to making it from natural gas using carbon capture, said Jane Patton, campaign manager for U.S. Fossil Economy at the Center for International Environmental Law. This is not a transfer off of fossil fuel dependency. This is a perpetuation of fossil fuel dependency. Bob Bullard, founding director of the Bullard Center for Environmental and Climate Justice at Texas Southern University, known by many as the father of environmental justice and now a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council, said he's seen no proof that a build-out of hydrogen and carbon storage will be any better for local communities than the expansion of the petrochemical industry was over the past century, bringing more pollution than benefits to surrounding communities. He continued to call for a federal study to find out whether hydrogen production with carbon capture is safe for the people who live around it. One problem is that the current low-carbon hydrogen model inappropriately leaves out the fact that hydrogen pipelines could leak, Schlissel says. Hydrogen can react with the molecule that breaks down harmful methane in the atmosphere and make the methane last longer, contributing to climate change. Speakers at the environmentalist event also expressed little confidence in the Railroad Commission of Texas, which regulates the state's oil and gas industry to regulate hydrogen pipelines and underground storage. Commission Shift, a watchdog group that calls for reforming the Railroad Commission, says the agency has a poor track record when it comes to protecting Texans from explosions, leaks, and other problems with wells and pipelines. These advocates are up against wealthy, politically powerful companies that say making hydrogen from natural gas with carbon capture is a ready solution to start lowering how much carbon dioxide escapes into the atmosphere, even if it's imperfect. Chris Greig, a senior research scientist with the Andlinger Center for Energy and the Environment at Princeton University, said in an interview, "I find this polarization of seeking perfect at the expense of very good is problematic. And to be clear, the distrust of oil and gas companies is not unwarranted, right? There's been some things done wrong," Greig added. "But somehow we have to set that aside and find some sort of middle ground." I did the best I could editing this down from roughly 7 pages. There are other potential issues in addition to the legitimate environmental concerns about hydrogen as liberated for fuel. In June of 2010, at another station, I did a show on hydrogen as a potential fuel, and I learned some things. Two of the most important things I learned are the challenges of holding hydrogen in a container and the effect that hydrogen has on containers used to hold it. Hydrogen, or H2, is a really tiny molecule. It's so light that it only stays on Earth when combined with other elements. Free hydrogen always escapes into space, as does helium. That makes it very challenging to develop materials that can contain it. The result is that there will always be hydrogen leaks in pipelines, tanks, tankers, etc., and that must be accounted for environmentally and for safety purposes. The second problem is called hydrogen embrittlement. It is described in Wikipedia thusly. Hydrogen embrittlement, also known as hydrogen-assisted cracking or hydrogen-induced cracking, is a reduction in the ductility of a metal due to absorbed hydrogen. Hydrogen atoms are small and can permeate solid metals. Once absorbed, hydrogen lowers the stress required for cracks in the metal to initiate and propagate, resulting in embrittlement. Hydrogen embrittlement occurs most notably in steels, as well as in iron, nickel, titanium, cobalt, and their allies. Copper, aluminum, and stainless steels are less susceptible to hydrogen embrittlement. You can go more to the link I've provided and see for yourself what's there. There are materials and coatings that can protect against embrittlement, but as with most things, caveats apply. None of this is to say that hydrogen shouldn't have a future as a transportable fuel, but there's still work to be done both in generating hydrogen and in how to best use it as a fuel. Moving on to national news, you've probably heard aspects of this story. Utah lawmaker blames DEI for Baltimore Bridge collapse despite cargo ship collision. Utah State Representative Phil Lyman blamed diversity, equity, and inclusion for the catastrophic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Officials say a cargo ship caused the collapse when it struck a bridge support in the Patapsco River. Lyman, a Republican, drew criticism Tuesday when he shared a post on X from the Young Conservative Federation, noting that Baltimore Port Commissioner Corinthia Barber has a background, quote, in diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. Wrote Lyman, "This is what happens when you have governors who prioritize diversity over the well-being and security of citizens," said Lyman, who was running for Utah governor. The bridge collapse is just the latest in a string of problems right-wing activists have blamed on DEI programs. Posted by Wall Street trader and podcaster Ben Kahn, he said, "Calling any and all failures of governments, institutions, engineering, or businesses the sole fault of DEI initiatives has become coded for, they put black people in charge instead of white people." My observation would be that Baltimore Port Commissioner Corinthia Barber happens to be black, so instead of just being an honest racist and saying, "This bridge collapsed because Commissioner Barber is black," Lyman is saying she has a background in DEI, which he uses to mean the same thing. I don't have much else to say to this except that people who blame DEI for everything or anything are really just racists, period. Our next story is from CNN.com. Now, as a general rule, I avoid using the time of this show to discuss widely covered news stories unless I feel I have something useful to add, but I think the story I'm citing here makes some good points. It's titled Takeaways from the Supreme Court Arguments Over the Abortion Drug Mifepristone. I should know how to pronounce it by now. Anyway, a majority of Supreme Court justices appeared skeptical Tuesday of the idea of a nationwide ban or new limits on mifepristone, the primary drug used for medication abortions. The case may simply be determined on whether the doctors who brought the original lawsuit had the ability to bring the case in the first place. A decision is expected by July. During the second hour of arguments, Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Neil Gorsuch tore into the challenger's attorney over the nationwide impact caused by the lawsuit. Why can't the court specify that this relief runs to precisely the parties before the court, as opposed to looking to the agency in general and saying, "Agency, you can't do this anywhere," Roberts asked the plaintiff's attorney, Aaron Hawley. As she began to explain how such a remedy would be impractical, Gorsuch interjected to speak to the recent spike in universal injunctions. He said he went back and looked, and there are exactly zero universal injunctions that were used during Franklin Delano Roosevelt's 12 years in office. Pretty consequential ones. And over the last 4 years or so, the number is something like 60, and maybe more than that, he continued. And they're a relatively new thing. And you're asking us to extend and pursue this relatively new course, which this court has never adopted itself. Gorsuch went on to say, "This case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule or any other government action. The Biden administration contends that even if some action in favor of the plaintiffs was warranted, it should not have affected the entire country, as opposed to just the litigants in the case." Solicitor General Elizabeth Preloger said that what the court did is enter sweeping nationwide relief that restricts access to mifepristone for every single woman in the country, and that causes profound harm. The discussion at one point turned to a key question. If the doctors challenging the nationwide approval of mifepristone can simply raise a conscientious objection that doesn't require them to assist in an abortion rather than force a nationwide ban on the drug. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh asked whether federal law provides some protections for doctors who object to providing an abortion on moral and religious grounds, a sign that he may not be convinced that the plaintiff doctors had the legal right, known as standing, to bring their suit against the FDA since they could not demonstrate any injury to them stemming from the agency's regulations. Just to confirm on the standing issue, Kavanaugh said, under federal law, no doctors can be forced against their consciences to perform or assist on an abortion, correct? Said Kavanaugh, who is sometimes a swing vote on the court, asked Preloger. Yes, we think that federal conscience protections provide broad coverage here, Preloger said. We think that those amendments guard against the kind of injury that respondents are asserting. Justice Samuel Alito, who wrote the opinion reversing Roe v. Wade, and fellow ardent abortion opponent Justice Clarence Thomas pushed the question of whether anyone can actually challenge the FDA on drug approvals. The FDA wants to be infallible, Alito said at one point. Is there anybody who can sue and get a judicial ruling on whether what FDA did was lawful? And maybe what they did was perfectly lawful, but shouldn't somebody be able to challenge that in court, Alito asked? Preloger stressed that challengers to FDA drug approvals need to show concrete harm to themselves, not simply a wider objection to policy. That the challenge to mifepristone reached the Supreme Court in such a short amount of time was no accident, a result of the judge shopping phenomenon seen most recently on major political issues including health care, firearms, and abortion. The U.S. Judicial Conference this month instituted process changes that would limit the guaranteed impact of judge shopping, but that doesn't mean social and political lawsuits won't continue. From my point of view, it's always hazardous to guess what this court will do. The story makes it sound like a majority will vote against the plaintiffs in this case, maybe even by as much as 7-2, but we'll have to wait until somewhere around July to find out. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central, Thursdays at 6 p.m., and Sundays at 1 p.m. You can also hear the show by visiting archive.kpft.org for episodes of this show and over 100 other KPFT programs. We heavily excerpt most stories, so I link to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com, which is now the landing page. You can also visit kpft.org to find out what's new at the station, catch up with your favorite shows on the archive, and help KPFT keep the lights on by clicking the donate button. You can also donate by calling KPFT at 713-526-5738 extension 1. That's 713-526-5738 extension 1. And you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. Just ask. You can send us your thoughts about our show by emailing thinkwingradio@msn.com. We're also on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and I'm on Threads and Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Now leading us to world political economic news, Chinese property developer Evergrande faces a $120 billion fraud accusation, and its chairman is barred for life. Here's what we know so far. This is from ABCNET.au, that's the Australian broadcasting company. The founder of embattled property developer Evergrande has been barred for life from China's financial markets after the company allegedly falsified its revenue by almost $120 billion. The firm is one of the world's most indebted property developers, defaulting on its debt in 2021 and applying for bankruptcy in the U.S. in mid-2023. Its chairman, Wei Kai-yan, was detained for suspected illegal crimes in September. Evergrande said regulators found it had overstated its revenue in 2019 by 214 billion yuan, or $45.3 billion. In 2020, its revenue was allegedly overstated by nearly 80%, or 350 billion yuan, or $74.1 billion. The China Securities Regulatory Commission also suspects problems with bonds Evergrande issued, it said. Auditors will likely be on the hook for some blame, according to Reuters columnists. PricewaterhouseCoopers' China affiliate quit last year as Evergrande's accountant, and liquidators were already planning to sue the unit, they said. Enron's collapse famously precipitated, along with the scandal at telecom company WorldCom, the demise of the then Big Five accounting firm Arthur Andersen. The Evergrande fiasco could accelerate the retreat of the Big Four in China. PricewaterhouseCoopers' mainland, Hong Kong, and Macau operations boast over 800 partners. The Chinese government has increased support for the real estate industry, listing thousands of projects eligible for loans from state banks that are stepping up to help contain the damage. Party leaders have emphasized that they want to ensure that families are able to obtain housing they have paid for. But developers borrowed heavily as they turned cities into forests of apartment and office towers, pushing total corporate, government, and household debt to more than 300% of the country's annual economic output, unusually high for a middle-income country. Fidelity International's investment director Catherine Yeung told the ABC in January that other private property developers could still go down the same track. Evergrande's liquidation is a sign that China is willing to go to extreme ends to quell the property bubble, said Andrew Collier, managing director of Orient Capital Research in Hong Kong, when the judgment came down. The Reserve Bank of Australia has warned problems caused by the deterioration of China's property sector could spark a global slowdown, weaker commodity prices, and reduce Chinese imports of Australian goods and services. Widespread financial stress in China would affect the advanced economy financial systems, mostly via its impact on Chinese trade and a general increase in risk aversion in global financial markets, the RBA wrote in a recent financial stability review. And in case you missed it, the preceding story is from Australia Broadcasting Company. I've been following this story for months. We've discussed it on the show before, and there were times I wanted to do updates, but we just ran out of time. It seems to me that there are parallels here to the financial crisis that hit the U.S. and other countries in 2008. Being too big to fail was a concern then and continues to being an ongoing concern among many political and economic theorists to this day. It's a big reason why the Biden administration is beginning to reapply antitrust laws that had lain dormant for decades under both Democratic and Republican governance. Economies of scale and mega mergers have given rise to fears of market segment control and price fixing. The dilemma facing China is now an equivalent to the 2008 financial crisis, even to the parts that concerns of too big to fail and real estate speculation is playing in it. The Chinese government is having to decide what companies should fail, what parts of these companies may need to be preserved in the national interest, and how to let failing companies die as an object lesson to other businesses and how they conduct themselves in the future. They also have to consider how to limit who thought they were buying homes in good faith, how to keep consumer confidence in the economy and the Chinese Communist Party from unraveling, and how to prevent major damage to the Chinese economy as a whole. Positive outcomes are not guaranteed. From about 4 weeks ago, I've been holding this as what I thought was an interesting story. From BBC News, U.S. says falling trade with China could be positive. The steep drop in trade with China could be a positive development, the U.S. top trade official has told the BBC. Catherine Tai said it isn't necessarily negative. It could be a positive indication of diversification on both sides. The amount of goods the world's two biggest economies sold to each other fell 17% last year. It comes amid deepening divisions in the global economy. These differences were exposed again with the U.S. announcing an investigation into what it said was a potential national security risk from cars made in China, citing fears that tech-connected cars could collect personal data or be controlled remotely. Chinese car companies have been expanding their presence in other parts of the world but have virtually no presence in the U.S., where they already face import duties of 25%. The White House described its action as unprecedented and a fair response to Chinese policies which impose restrictions on foreign car companies. Last year, the amount of goods the U.S. bought from China fell just over 20% to $427 billion, with a 4% fall the other way to just under $148 billion. Trade between the two hit a record high in 2022, but has fallen as many big U.S. companies move production outside of China. Amid growing tensions between the two countries, trade expert William Reinsch of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says last year's decline in U.S.-China trade does appear to be a sign that both economies are moving away from each other. But if you look at the increased imports from Southeast Asia into the United States, it appears a good part of that increase is coming from Chinese companies that have either moved production or are simply moving their products through third countries in order to circumvent tariffs or other restrictions. President Biden and President Xi struggled to make progress on trade when they met in California in November. The U.S. has been leading calls for reform of the World Trade Organization, WTO, in recent years. Under Donald Trump's presidency, it disabled the dispute resolution body by blocking the appointment of new judges, arguing that the system and its rulings favored China at the expense of the U.S. That blockade and call for reform have continued under Joe Biden's presidency, despite his team revealing very little of the changes they want publicly. Ambassador Tai said that the WTO is here to serve the interests of all of its members, large and small. Trade relations between the world's two biggest economies have worsened under the Biden administration, with both the U.S. and China imposing new barriers on trade, including restrictions on computer chip exports, which have recently suffered shortages. Liu Pengyu, a spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington, told the BBC, quote, "Upholding sound and steady growth of China-U.S. economic and trade ties serves the fundamental interest of both countries and our peoples and is conducive to global economic growth." Mr. Liu added that the two sides should work together on global challenges and hoped the U.S. would move in the same direction. Both countries are trying to grow their economic influence in parts of Africa and Asia as they try to secure access to natural resources and build resilience into supply chains. It has led to growing concerns that the world is splitting into two trading blocks. A WTO study found such a division could cost the world economy 5% of its GDP. Believe it or not, this story can be traced all the way back to Nixon's visit to China in 1972. The reasons for this opening to what was then commonly referred to as Red China were strictly geopolitical. Cracks had been appearing in the Big Brother relationship that China had with the Soviet Union since 1949, with China as the junior partner and the USSR as the Big Brother. Over time, this relationship began to chafe China. There had even been some border conflict between China and the USSR in 1969. This is the result of a long history between these two nations, and I have linked to the longer story and references below this blog post. Thus, both China and the United States began to see this as a useful time to expand their relations with each other to counterbalance Soviet power and influence. This new multipolar geopolitical dynamic served the interests of both parties at the time. This new dynamic led corporations in the U.S. and Europe to see China as a vast potential new market for selling their products and eventually as a cheap place to move their production to. Thus began the offshoring and deindustrialization of the U.S. Midwest and elsewhere versus the now increasing economic and industrial might and influence of China. From a geopolitical perspective, Western governments also hoped that this new interconnectedness with the West might lead to some political liberalization in China. At least this is what they told themselves and us. This more or less brings us to the current story. The pendulum is now swinging back in the other direction. Onshoring and reindustrializing America is now seen as the national security necessity. There will still be offshored production for U.S. companies, but they will be increasingly less concentrated and more diverse among countries in South and Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And I've been saving this last story for a while. From phys.org, phys.org, new research finds that ancient carbon in rocks releases as much carbon dioxide as the world's volcanoes. A new study led by the University of Oxford, new at the time, has overturned the view that natural rock weathering acts as a CO2 sink, indicating that instead this can also act as a large CO2 source, rivaling that of volcanoes. The results published in the journal Nature have important implications for modeling climate change scenarios. Rocks contain an enormous store of carbon in the ancient remains of plants and animals that lived millions of years ago. This means that the geological carbon cycle acts as a thermostat that helps to regulate the Earth's temperature. For instance, during chemical weathering, rocks can suck up CO2 when certain minerals are attacked by the weak acid found in rainwater. This process helps to counteract the continuous CO2 released by volcanoes around the world and forms part of Earth's natural carbon cycle that has helped keep the surface habitable for life for a billion years or more. However, for the first time, this new study measured an additional natural process of CO2 release from rocks to the atmosphere, finding that it is as significant as the CO2 released from volcanoes around the world. Currently, this process is not included in most models of the natural carbon cycle. This story goes into more detail and is an interesting read, so I suggest you look it up on the blog post. And as the saying goes, the more you know. I think that what we're seeing here is an example of chaos theory in action. In order to predict how a chaotic situation will turn out, you need to know all the possible variables that affect the chaotic event being studied. But even then, chaos has microvariables that cannot be adequately predicted because there are too many solutions, even with perfect knowledge of the environment being studied. Maybe some things will never be better than a best guess, even if it's a really, really good guess. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig from KPFT Houston 90.1 FM HD2, Galveston 89.5 HD2, and Huntsville 89.7 HD2. We are Houston's community media. We hope you've enjoyed the show and found it interesting and look forward to sharing this time with you again next week. Y'all take care.
This is KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. Join me Monday mornings at 9 a.m. on KPFT 90.1 FM and streaming at kpft.org.
Hey, KPFT loyalists. Have you been on the fence about becoming a Sustainer member? Well, now is the perfect time to jump fully in. Until March 31st, all Sustainer members will be automatically entered into a drawing for two free tickets to the sold-out Lyle Lovett Jesse Dayton concert at the fabulously intimate and iconic Anderson Fair venue on April 20th. Find out details of how to become a Sustainer member now at kpft.org or by calling the station at 713-526-5738, option 1.
Y'all come back now to Honest Clyde's. We'll give you a good deal.
Yeah, I got your good deal, Honest Clyde.
Now, honey, be nice.
Well, the guy was lowballing us. This car is worth three times as much as he was offering. Let's get out of here. Turn on the radio.
That was another great song on KPFT. Do you have a car that you don't use and you need it gone? Donate it to KPFT. It's tax deductible, and we can arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from the sale are invested in KPFT, helping keep community radio on the air. Call 1-855-KPFT-CAR.
What a great idea! We can get a tax deduction and support KPFT.
It is a great idea. Call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Okay, that's 1-855-573-8227.